Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. It's graduation time again across the country, with colleges and universities holding commencement exercises, including Boston University earlier today. In honor of all the hard work leading up to this important milestone in a young person's life, we thought we'd share with you some of that work, specifically stories written and produced by students from this semester's advanced radio journalism class in the College of Communication here at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: produce a story based on a theme of transition or transformation. As you might guess, the topics varied widely. We begin with a look at one of the most exciting but stressful transitions for any family, the addition of a new baby. And it's not just stressful for parents, but for siblings too, as student reporter Lisa Zelig explains.
Meet Galia Moran and her 2.5-year-old daughter, Geffen. In less than a month, Geffen will lose her title of the only child.
How did you sleep?
Great.
Yeah, we've been drinking a lot of bottles at night. So we get a little soaky, don't we?
Moran always knew that she wanted her family to grow.
Both me and my husband come from big families, and it was very natural for us to think about having a second child.
But she worried about how Geffen would respond to a new family member. And as I found, with good reason.
Once upon a time was a big girl.
And what else was there? Was there a little girl?
Yes. Crying.
What is his big sister going to do to help?
Push the baby in the closet.
You want to push the baby in the closet?
Yes.
What if the baby doesn't like it in the closet?
He likes in the closet.
Yeah? Where are you going to be?
In my bedroom.
In your bedroom?
Yes.
And the baby's going to be in the closet?
Yes. Stay in the closet.
To make the transition easier for Geffen, her mother enrolled her in a sibling preparation class at Newton Wellesley Hospital, taught by Sue Fernandes.
All right, so why did we come to Newton Wellesley Hospital today? Why did you come here?
Because we got to learn about babies.
Oh, we're going to learn about babies. Why? Is something happening in your family soon?
New baby.
You try to give the children an idea of what having a baby at their home would be like, what the baby can do. We run through everything a baby can do and a baby cannot do. We talk about how they might feel about becoming an older brother or a sister, how there's a lot of happiness with that, and sometimes there are a lot of feelings, angry feelings, jealous feelings.
Geffen's aversion to her future baby sister is not uncommon in Fernandes' class.
We really try to make them a big part of it and to tell them, and it's very normal sometimes to be mad or sad, but it's not okay to ever hurt the baby, and we stress that. And when my daughter was born, my son, when I brought her home, said, "Can we take her to the dump now?" So those are all very, very normal feelings.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to Geffen. Happy birthday to you.
Less than 3 weeks later, Geffen's baby sister Tamar arrived. Now the Moran family is finding out how much sibling preparation is paying off.
She was born a little bit over a week ago, 8 days ago. It's been an incredible positive experience. We've been very, very happy to have this baby. Sometimes she likes helping out with her and time to time to hold her, but for the most part, it feels like she's ignoring her.
Not only has Geffen decided that ignoring the new family member is her best plan of action, she's also reluctant to talk about her sister to me.
Geffen, what happened last week?
Wee, 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 wee.
Did you get a new sister?
Yes.
Do you play games with your sister yet?
No.
Did you give your sister any hugs and kisses?
No.
Do you like her?
I'm more than of this game.
I actually really empathize with her. A friend of mine said to me, imagine that Your husband came one day and said, and brought with him a woman, and a charming woman, and said, you know, well, she's now come here to stay with us and live with us, and she's like my other wife, and you just have to sort of accept it and deal with it. And when you think about it that way, it's really hard, right?
One thing that's taught at the sibling preparation class is that you should keep an open dialogue between you and your child.
Some of the times when she cries, she says, my baby is crying. She says my baby a lot, mm-hmm. which is nice. So she kind of sees her as belonging to her naturally. But just having to get adjusted to it will take a while.
Oh!
You know what? I'd bet that the real problems won't begin until Tamar is old enough to start stealing Geffen's clothes, makeup, or boyfriends.
That's student reporter Lisa Zelig. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. We're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. I'm Deborah Becker. Like the arrival of a new baby, the arrival of a new pet can change families too. Student reporter Carolyn Burke explains what some families do to make sure their new pet fits in.
It's graduation day at Zen Dog Training School in Belmont. These pets have learned more than how to sit and play dead. In this class, dogs and owners learn to communicate with one another.
Dogs live in the present moment, which is why I called it Zen Dog Training.
Gordon Fontaine is the founder of Zen Dog Training.
The dog jumps on me, I say, ah, and I turn my back. And I wait until he sits, and he sits, I say, oh, you're so smart, and I pet him again, and then he gets up, I say, ah, and we call it radioactive dog. Versus, you know, the old days, he used to, like, the dog would jump, you'd step on his back. Pause, you'd like supposedly maybe kick him in the groin. Awful, awful things.
Fontaine's method of training is the same one used by many animal trainers. Amy Sutherland wrote about trainers and their behaviorist approaches in her book, What Shamu Taught Me About Life, Love, and Marriage.
You reinforce what you want and you ignore what you don't. So everything in the world is designed to repeat what basically got it the goods and to not things that weren't successful, that didn't get them what they wanted.
Positive reinforcement works so well for the animal trainers that Sutherland decided to try the same techniques on her husband.
I thought about a behavior that my husband has that drives me insane, and that is he loses his keys and wallet all the time. And it wasn't the losing the keys and wallet so much, but the how frustrated and angry he grew about them. And about the losing them. And so, I had found in the past that whenever I engaged and tried to help or call out suggestions or, you know, whatever I did to, and I sometimes lost my temper back at him. That didn't work very well either. But nothing worked, and he seemed to get madder and more frustrated. So I thought to myself, you know, I'm doing exactly what an animal trainer wouldn't, and that is I'm engaging in this behavior I don't like. So the next time he lost his keys, I thought like a dolphin trainer, and I just ignored the whole episode, and he not only didn't lose his temper as much, but he found his keys pretty quickly.
But not all people, or dogs, respond to training. Garrett Harris adopted his mixed-breed hound, Clyde, from a shelter in Sudbury. Clyde immediately became part of the family, but he became anxious and even destructive whenever someone new came into the house.
And we tried, you know, with both trainers to get some tips for how to deal with his behavior when people came in the house, but they just weren't that effective. One of the trainers suggested the thing of having a stranger, like a friend of ours, volunteer to come over and repeatedly, you know, ring the doorbell, and we'd open up the door, and then as soon as that person began to enter the house, we gave the dog a treat. So we were trying with a sort of like a behavior response type thing to get him associate people coming into the house with the positive benefit of getting a treat. And that seemed in the moment to help a little bit, but we couldn't get any long-term benefit from it. So when we talked to both the trainer we were working with and with Clyde's veterinarian, you know, the thing that came up was to see a behaviorist.
And yes, the Harrises found an animal behaviorist.
Sometimes these things actually need medical treatment.
Dr. Nicholas Dodman is a behaviorist at Tufts Veterinary School.
Same as people who have the same type conditions. They're treated medically with drugs that modify behaviors. They happen to be in the same class as Prozac. They happen to work.
Harris was surprised, but decided putting his dog on Zoloft was better than the alternative.
We were getting to the point where we were going to have to bring the dog back to the shelter if we couldn't get some progress with him. And we did not want to do that. And so the benefit of you know, keeping the dog and trying to work with him and trying to do what we could to deal with the issue, you know, outweighed any downside. So it seemed like a totally reasonable thing to do.
Dr. Dobman wishes more people saw it that way. He says uncontrollable barking and excessive chewing or scratching are signs of anxiety. That can be treated. But those behaviors lead some families to leave their dogs at a shelter.
An unknown number of millions of animals were being surrendered to shelters and pounds because of behavior problems that veterinarians and trainers were unable to fix. And where in the shelter of pounds, it's a two-thirds death sentence. Actually, bad behavior that can't be fixed, which is the main reason, it's at least 70% of all surrender, is because of behavior problems that owners can no longer tolerate, that they don't think can be fixed and they haven't got the right solutions. This sort of mortality is actually greater than all of the infectious diseases put together.
As for Clyde, antidepressants are working. Garrett Harris can't believe the difference.
It's been almost a year, I think, maybe even more, but almost a year since we used the medication, and you know, his behavior is much more reasonable, and I think it'll go so more in line with what, you know, a mature dog would exhibit.
For Clyde and these recent graduates of Zen dog training, humans understanding the workings of their brain is nothing to sniff at.
Who let the dogs out?
That story filed by student reporter Carolyn Burke. We'll hear another story from her later in the program. Some of the most difficult transitions people face involve aging and changing bodies. In a few minutes, some new hope for people with hearing loss. But first, we consider housing. Senior citizens have a growing list of choices. Aside from nursing homes, there are assisted living, continuous care retirement communities, or what are called village associations. Student reporter Varsha Yeshwant looks at some of the options.
My niece, when she came, bought me this kettle because I keep on burning out kettles. It's terrible.
Diana Ambrose is 75. For the past 9 years, she has been a member of Beacon Hill Village, a nonprofit organization that offers assistance to seniors who aren't ready to give up their homes.
Their aim is to keep people in their homes instead of retirement communities. And they do offer some services. Meals delivered to you. They organize shopping. I had some surgery, for example. You know, I was able to arrange for them to come and collect me from the hospital.
Ambrose would like to stay in her home for as long as she can, but is hedging her bets. She's visited a retirement community in Hingham, where a friend now lives. She doesn't have a car and worries that living in the suburbs would restrict her freedom. And there is something else that bothers her.
Lovely people, but, you know, it's a grey-haired mob of people. You know, you're with the same age group. I've got quite a lot of younger friends, and I'm not so sure whether they would come down and see me in Hingham. I'm certainly apprehensive, very much so.
But Ambrose knows she'll have to make a change sometime and says she hopes she can make a decision before it's made for her. It's a decision that some people put off for too long. Marcia Frankel is the clinical director of senior services at Jewish Family and Children's Services in Waltham.
I think it helps to delay it, and people are hoping to avoid having to go somewhere. They're hoping to remain in their home, in the community they're comfortable in. This is an option, as are the upscale retirement communities, for a very small proportion of the population who are financially capable, and the majority of people can't afford it.
And Frankel says that some seniors eventually must recognize that they need to take the next step, assisted living.
People generally move in directly to an assisted living facility because of a change in circumstance, either their own health. Sometimes it's that a spouse or other partner, care partner, has died or has become incapacitated.
That's what 99-year-old Floyd Crellin came to realize. He is the oldest resident of Goddard House, an assisted living facility in Brookline. His decision to move there was a painful one.
It's a poor, very poor one. I had to say goodbye to my dear wife.
His wife has Alzheimer's, and Krellen took care of her in their home in Rochester for as long as he could. But then he broke his hip.
I was getting all the meals and doing everything, and I would have to be doing that now, and I can't do it. I had to make a decision one way or the other. I had to either stay, or which I couldn't do. I couldn't go back and live with my wife anymore, so I had to leave her, and that was tough. That was the toughest thing I ever did.
Even tougher, because Krellen decided to leave New York altogether.
Getting this age, you know, you run out of relatives, you see. And that was my problem. I ran out of relatives up in Rochester. And my son, who's here, lives just on the other side of the pond here. 5 minutes, if I call him, 5 minutes he can be here.
Difficulty with this transition is proportional to elders' role in the decision-making process, says social worker Marsha Frankel.
When people are competent, they're able to make their own choices. The people who are not having any say about where they're going or what they're doing tend to have a more difficult adjustment.
This transition may not be one that all of us can avoid, but we can still choose how much of a say we have over when and where we go.
That's student reporter Varsha Yashwant. This is WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Among the challenges some senior citizens must address is hearing loss. For some, traditional hearing aids don't correct the problem, or they're just unpleasant to wear. As student reporter Taylor Aldrich tells us, it's a dilemma that some engineering students at Boston University hope to solve.
For their entire senior year, Dana Yeager and Jared Safi have been working to create a new type of hearing aid. These BU engineering students have been working with both the biomedical engineering department and BU's dental school to create a working prototype. But instead of going in the ear, this hearing aid would fit over a tooth. Why the mouth and not the ear? For people with middle ear disease. Yeager says standard hearing aids can't help those people.
Hearing through air conduction is when sound energy passes through the ear canal and stimulates the cochlea through the air. And bone conduction is when the cochlea is stimulated by vibrations in the facial bones.
There's only one option for people with middle ear disease right now. But as Yeager's partner Jared Safi explains, it's pretty intrusive.
There's current devices out there now that involve drilling into the skull, but obviously surgery is not ideal for many patients who need a hearing aid. So what we were trying to do is come up with a device that goes around the surgery route to help these people.
And not just them. A more comfortable device placed in the mouth could be an option for lots of people with hearing loss. Dr. Dan Nathanson of the Restorative Sciences and Biomaterials Department at the Dental School is spearheading the effort between several departments at BU to develop a new hearing aid. He says the mouth is the best place for a hearing aid.
The mouth has more innervation than almost any other part of the body. The mouth is so well innervated that if I locally anesthetized your upper and lower teeth and put a hair between your teeth and told you to bite, you would be able to tell me whether there is a hair there or not. That's how sensitive that the area of the mouth is in terms of sensory innervation.
The use of bone reverberation to improve hearing has been around longer than you might think. Biomedical engineering professor David Mountain is also assisting Yeager and Safi on their hearing device.
This idea of getting sound to the inner ear from the teeth is actually very old. Beethoven used it when he was going deaf, and there's some very interesting patents from the late 1800s where people were trying to develop a replacement for the ear trumpet using this technique. And so it's well known that if you vibrate the teeth, you can get sound into the ear. And of course, the challenge is to try to figure out, can you make some sort of device that would be comfortable, could fit into the mouth and vibrate the teeth?
And the applications are not limited to assisting the hearing impaired. Imagine a phone or an iPod that fits neatly over the tooth. Again, Dr. Dan Nathanson.
A pretty amazing thing because, say, in all kind of operations, having the stuff in the mouth and not outside the body is pretty attractive because, first of all, it doesn't show. So nobody knows that you have a sound device. You know, nobody can see that you're even hearing something, so it's very attractive. It's an attractive thing.
Safi and Jaeger are leaving school without having finished the sleek tooth cap. But they have a mouth guard that will enable you to listen to music through the bones in your face. Getting to that step allows future students to take that project as far as they can next year. And the professors helping out are confident someday soon there will be an entirely new type of hearing aid available.
Student reporter Taylor Aldridge filed that report. This is WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. We're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. The theme of tonight's stories is transition or transformation. It's not just people who experience transformation. For example, what used to be one of the dirtiest rivers in the country. Student reporter Michelle Flum takes a tour of the Charles River.
It's a cool spring day in a quiet, out-of-the-way spot in Medfield, southwest of Boston. I put on my life jacket and slip on my neoprene shoes. I carry my kayak down to the river's edge. The Medfield wastewater treatment plant looms large in the distance. I stepped into the toe-numbing waters, scrambled into the boat, released the rudder, and set off. Birds chirp overhead. A turtle clings to a fallen log, basking in the morning sun. A red-winged blackbird clings to bracken, deadened by last winter's cruel cold, and gently sways in the breeze.
There has been a lot more, as I understand, a lot more wildlife and bird life in the upper Charles that you can now see great blue heron fairly regularly.
That's Bill Walsh Rogowski. He directs the EPA's Clean the Charles River initiative. For the past 15 years, he's been working to create a fishable and swimmable Charles River.
In the lower Charles, we get a lot more striped bass coming in.
This is a big change since the EPA zeroed in on the river in 1995. For decades, untreated sewage was dumped into the river. Parts of Boston have what's called a combined sewer system. Scientist Julie Wood of the Charles River Watershed Association explains.
You have pipes that carry both your stormwater runoff and your wastewater from your house, from your toilets. When we have large rain events, the pipes literally get full. To prevent it from backing up into the streets, it gets discharged into the river.
There's been far less untreated wastewater in the river since the opening of the Deer Island Treatment Plant in 1995. Other projects are in the works now. They include increasing the storage capacity and creating separate wastewater and stormwater systems in some areas. Federal regulators are also working with cities and towns to find and shut off places where sewage pipes are legally connected to storm drains. Scientist Julie Wood, however, says the biggest challenge facing the river today is storm drains.
When rainwater hits these impervious surfaces, it runs over them and it collects anything that's on the roadway, anything that's on the parking lot. That's called stormwater runoff pollution. Stormwater runoff is not treated at any sort of wastewater treatment plant. It runs off and then goes into catch basins, into pipes, and ends up in our major river.
The problem is phosphorus. It's a fertilizer. It's in fallen leaves. It's also spewed out by car mufflers and smokestacks.
So you're essentially fertilizing your river. You're feeding it. So you get all this large overgrowth of plants.
That includes blue-green algae, which produces a toxin that can make you and your pets sick. And the trouble doesn't end there. Again, Julie Wood of the Charles River Watershed Association.
This large biomass dies, it sinks down to the bottom of the river, and as it degrades, it needs oxygen to degrade. So it gets the oxygen from the dissolved oxygen that's in the water column.
The oxygen that fish and other aquatic animals need to breathe. This could result in what scientists call dead zones in the river, which cannot support any aquatic life. The EPA's Bill Walsh Rogowski says there's a lot people can do to keep the Charles healthy.
One of the things people can do is manage their pets better. People can reduce fertilizer use. You don't even need phosphorus to grow good lawns here.
Or simply keep your stormwater in your backyard in rain barrels. But it's not enough. Now federal regulators have an aggressive new plan to tackle this problem. Beginning in Milford, Bellingham, and Franklin, the EPA wants to require property owners with 2 or more acres of hard, impervious surfaces, like parking lots and roadways, to reduce phosphorus levels to meet water quality standards.
They can do very aggressive street sweeping. They can manage leaf litter. They can minimize use of fertilizer.
They can also install systems to absorb the phosphorus and return clean water to the ground. Bill Walsh-Rogowski says these systems are an especially good choice because they curb flooding and replenish our underground sources of water called aquifers.
Throughout a lot of New England, people get their drinking water right out of the ground. And in some communities in the Charles, there's been such depletion that people have to limit the use of their water in the summer. You have lawn watering bans and the like, and that's all a function of the aquifers drying up.
Back on the Charles River, a flat-tailed muskrat paces back and forth on a discarded styrofoam block, mustering up the confidence to take the plunge. I share its hesitation. It jumps in. I return to shore, wondering if I'll ever do the same. Last summer, the Charles River was swimmable 62% of the time. The EPA's Bill Walsh-Rogowski anticipates that in 3 years, the river will be swimmable almost all of the time. However, he stresses, there are no guarantees.
Student reporter Michelle Flom. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. We're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. I'm Deborah Becker. Every day, we all experience the transition from being awake to falling asleep. But for some of us, that can be incredibly difficult. Student reporter Lindsay Dorman looks at what's being done to help.
Teresa Este, a teacher in the Boston Public Schools, is surprisingly energetic, given that she runs on about 3 hours of sleep a night. Stress from the day stays with her when she comes home and prevents her from getting a good night's sleep.
I do all the thinking at night, whatever I'm going to do the next day, or this issue, or the other issue, or this. It's always something that is going to aggravate me. I'm a very, very worried person. I try not to think about it when I go to sleep, but it can happen, you know.
Este is not alone. She's among the throngs of busy, multitasking Americans who have trouble relaxing. They try any number of things, from drugs to changing daily routines, just to get some sleep. But for many, the answer could be sound. This lullaby contains carefully engineered sounds that might help people fall asleep.
I'm Professor Seth Horowitz, Brown University Department of Neuroscience, and I'm the CEO and Chief Neuroscientist for Neuropop.
Horowitz teamed up with electronic music composer Lance Massey to form their company Neuropop. It produces CDs it says help people sleep. It works like this. Start with some soothing classical or ambient music. Then add some low rumbling.
One of the things that people who are exposed to low-frequency vibration suffer from is falling asleep. It's a form of motion sickness. Normally, you think of motion sickness as nauseogenic, but there's another form of motion sickness, which is called Sopite syndrome, which is very common. It's exposure to low-frequency sound, low-frequency vibration at very low amplitudes. It directly connects to sleep centers in the brain and arousal centers, and you fall asleep. It's related to the idea that you can rock a baby to sleep.
In other words, sound and balance are connected. Low-frequency noise and gentle rocking put people to sleep in similar ways. Neuropop takes advantage of the auditory part of this. Next, they incorporate binaural beating. That's the effect where sound wavers back and forth between the left and right speakers. Think of Pink Floyd's Welcome to the Machine. Horowitz says moving the sound back and forth at just the right rate makes you sleepy. Finally, he adds what sounds like wind, pulsing in and out at speeds that mimic slowed heartbeats and respiratory rates. He says listeners' pulses and breathing should naturally come into sync with what they're hearing. Neuropop tested the CD in a clinical trial with 26 people who have trouble falling asleep. Horowitz says for 3/4 of them, the CDs helped. They fell asleep quicker and stayed asleep longer.
This is just using the same effects that effective music will do, or an effective relaxation or hypnosis would do. The maximum effect you'll get would be probably just getting relaxed or tired, unless it's just not your kind of music, and then you'll ignore it.
At sleep health centers in Brighton, therapists use mind-body techniques to help people like Teresa Este, who have trouble relaxing. Rick Clarici, a behavioral sleep specialist and certified hypnotherapist, uses soothing sounds to help ease patients into hypnosis. In this calm yet focused state, they are more open to learning new behaviors and relaxation techniques.
You know, one of the things that we believe is that people are really filled with incredible resources, amazing ability to change and learn. It's just incredible. And hypnosis is just a tool that helps someone reach those resources inside, use them, feel more connected to them, more immersed in them.
As for the Neuropop CDs, Clarici believes they should be effective. But he tries to address sleep problems more deeply.
I just think that it's possible to go beyond that, to not only create good night's sleep on that night, but to be continuously building skills so that eventually the person doesn't really need the CD and has developed skills for, you know, for instance, not paying so much attention to their thoughts and thinking.
Clarici's longtime patient, Teresa Este, is finding at least some relief.
I think I'm sleeping well. 3 and 4 hours for me is fantastic, because sometimes I was all night completely awake. So it's getting better.
For some people who have trouble silencing their thoughts, some clever use of sound may be just what they need to direct the brain to sleep.
Student reporter Lindsay Dorman. This is WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. We're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. The theme of tonight's stories is transition and transformation. A notable transition from the last century is the role of women in society. More women are in leadership roles in business, government, and religion. The first female rabbi in America was ordained in 1972. Today, female students find themselves in the majority at some rabbinical schools. Student reporter Casey Atkins explores the transformation that could create in Judaism.
When many people think of a rabbi, a lot of us still conjure up the same iconic image.
I always experienced a male rabbi. He was always older, had a beard. You imagine he sat next to, you know, God somewhere in heaven. You know, not very approachable.
Adine Bregman is a member of Congregation Etz Chaim in Cambridge. There have been female rabbis in America for nearly 40 years now, and today they're becoming more common. In the Reform movement, classes in rabbinical schools are often up to 2/3 female. And in the conservative movement, out of the 1,600 members of the rabbinical assembly, 1 out of every 6 is a woman.
And when I was growing up, I was involved in my congregation and always wanted to make Judaism part of my life. But no one ever thought about women being rabbis. You know, women at that time, or myself personally, could not imagine ourselves in that role. So shortly thereafter, 5-6 years, things changed. And our daughter, Rachel, will be ordained from Hebrew Union College, which is the Reform movement. A majority of her classmates are women. What does that mean? Why are there more women taking leadership roles?
The female rabbi at Congregation Etz Chaim is well aware of the evolving role of women. Rabbi Liza Stern has watched the number of women in the rabbinate grow since she was ordained nearly 26 years ago. Rabbi Stern thinks that female rabbis have a different relationship with one another than male rabbis do, and simply see things in a different way.
Women in general seem to be more approachable, and so people will come to me with their stories, and they wouldn't go to a male rabbi, but they'll come to a female rabbi. They'll permit me to enter their lives in certain ways that they wouldn't
if I were a male.
Rabbi Stern thinks that female rabbis have a different relationship with one another than male rabbis do and simply see things in a different way. They're more open, she says, to sharing their problems and coming up with new solutions together.
Those things that we create end up filtering down to our communities and they become part of normative Judaism. So I think that the fact that women are permitted to be rabbis doesn't just have an impact on those women, it actually literally has an impact on what Judaism will look like in the future.
While most movements of Judaism today have female rabbis, one does not. In the Orthodox tradition, female rabbis are still not recognized. There are plenty of women who perform similar roles. They're just not called rabbis.
So the question is, what's a rabbi? That's the real question.
Joseph Pollack is an Orthodox rabbi at Boston University.
The Orthodox view on female rabbis is evolving. It's hardly fixed. The woman's rabbinate is in flux, right? It's not so clear that it's a good thing. It's just not clear at all. I don't think anyone's really interested in saying that women should not be rabbis and whatever. It's, you know, that's a very primitive discussion. The question is, does it work?
And Rabbi Pollack isn't so sure.
When the conservative reform movements welcomed women rabbis, something really interesting happened to their synagogues and their temples, and that is they all became filled with women. But the men were not comfortable, and that persists.
One poll suggests a direct link between female clergy and decreasing membership in churches and synagogues. According to U.S. News and World Report, the poll conducted by Mark Penn shows membership is down for all congregations with female clergy, whereas in other congregations, membership has increased. The theory is that female clergy are part of a larger movement of religion becoming more liberal, a trend that doesn't sit well with some of the parishioners.
But they don't want it in church on Sunday morning, is what the problem is. They want the fear of God for their kids.
As for the future, Rabbi Pollack says he can't predict what will happen.
The drive to equalize the rabbinate so that, you know, both sexes are represented may work, but Judaism may fail. There's something that worked pretty well for almost 4,000 years. If it ain't broke, you know, watch out.
So as female rabbis become more common, the question for many is how they might change Judaism.
Student reporter Casey Atkins. Here again is reporter Carolyn Burke with a story about a fellow student's gradual yet dramatic transformation while at Boston University.
Like most college students graduating this week, Sam has gone through a lot of changes since enrolling at Boston University 4 years ago. There's a new tattoo, there's a time spent studying in London, and there's a new Adam's apple. You see, Sam has changed gender, starting school as a woman, but graduating today as a man. Sam, who asked that we only use his first name, says growing up as a girl, he was a bit of a tomboy, but didn't think much about gender.
I didn't see myself as different or standing out. When I was a kid, you hear a lot of stories of like, oh, I've known since I was three that I was different than anyone else. And I didn't, not because I didn't feel masculine, but because I didn't see that as a problem, I guess.
Sam came out as bisexual and later homosexual in high school, mostly because of one very close friend.
I fell in love with her immediately. She did not fall in love with me immediately. But she warmed up to me. It was actually Noelle that was one of the things that made me realize a lot of stuff about myself, because meeting her and becoming very much interested in her kind of forced me to face certain things that I had been avoiding and not trying to think about.
They were only friends. But Melissa, who asked that we only use her first name, says there are moments of flirtation that confused her.
Like, there was an initial attraction there between both of us, but the problem is, like, I don't feel like a lesbian. I don't like the idea of being attracted to females. So I always kind of resisted, and all throughout high school, even though there was incredible sexual tension.
Sam and Melissa both received scholarships to Boston University, where they remained friends. It was during freshman year that Sam decided to make a change.
A very close friend died my freshman year during the first semester, and it was one of those realizations. It's something I'd been thinking about for a while and putting off and not wanting to deal with in terms of, you know, medical bills and talking to my family. And when he died, I just realized it was life's too short. It was time to get on with it. So,
Sam's transformation began with dressing in men's clothing and breast binding. He also officially came out to his friends.
I did that in person. I was just like, hey, y'all, can you call me he now? And they were like, none of us is very surprised by this.
Coming out to his parents was not as easy. You see, Sam has two mothers. As a lesbian couple, they had a hard time understanding why Sam had to live as a man to have a relationship with a woman.
They saw it almost as a betrayal because it was me being born female, dressing like a man, holding hands with a woman, and being a man. And that was really hard for them to deal with.
Sam began to save up money for breast removal surgery and hormone injections. These would help his body change into that of a man's. Genital surgery, however, is too expensive, so Sam says he'll hold off for now. With the transformation came a second puberty of sorts.
You know, you're sitting in class and you raise your hand to answer something and you're like, I think the middle church is up. And my friends are like, well, we all had to go through that too. I'm like, yeah, but you had to go through it when everyone else was going through it, not when you're 21 years old, sitting in your college class.
Sam now appears more male than ever. His shaggy hair is cut short, he's tall and bony, and he even has a small Adam's apple. However, Sam still feels caught between the two genders. Nowhere is that more clear than when he faces the dilemma of which bathroom to use.
If I go in a women's bathroom, the women are afraid and they're creeped out and they're wondering why a man is in the women's bathroom, and I've had people scream and run from the room before. And if I go in a men's bathroom, I'm largely ignored, but there's always that person who can tell that something's up or that I'm not, you know, born the right way. And I feel like I'm safer in a women's bathroom, but I also don't want to scare anyone, so I always use a men's bathroom, but I feel like I take a risk every time I do that, so.
After their friend's death, Melissa drifted away from Sam. When they both happened to be spending a semester in London, they reunited, and Melissa learned to see Sam as a man and as more than a friend.
He bought flowers for this girl in London. It was only because it was her birthday and he didn't know what to get her. But I got really upset. I flew into this, like, jealous rage about it and just started complaining to everybody, just like, can you believe what he did and stuff? And everyone's like, why? What's the problem? It's not like you guys go out. And I realized, like, this isn't a friendship. This is something different. These are different feelings.
Even though she knew him as an entirely different gender, Melissa says she's able to separate the Sam she's dating now from the girl she knew in high school.
I don't associate the two people as the same person. Like, that's a separate female friend I had in high school. This is my boyfriend now. It's kind of strange.
Sam is not just a different person physically, but legally as well. He has legally changed his name and gender, and the name on his new diploma matches the male identity he has been living as. After 3 years together, both Sam and Melissa plan to stay in Boston and with each other.
That was student reporter Carolyn Burke. I'm Deborah Becker with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, with student reporters considering transition and transformation. In our final story, we turn to music, something that is always evolving, but still some aspects of it remain constant. Here again is Michelle Flum with a look at the quest for the perfect sound.
The sound of the violin is so close to that of the human voice, and I loved that violin sound. So I started lessons, and that was it for me.
That's violinist Byla Keys. She teaches violin at Boston University. She's the founder of the piano trio Triple Helix and a member of the music ensemble of Boston Music Aviva. She plays on a violin made in 1740 in Milan by Gennaro Scagliano, whose father studied with the great luthier Antonio Stradivari. Gennaro Scagliano violins are highly coveted by collectors.
I bought it at a specialty violin shop called Bein & Fushi in Chicago. I bought it in 1981, and we bought it instead of a house. At the time, my father-in-law and my husband joked that perhaps we should build an extension on it so we would at least have some place to sleep.
Her Galliano violin was love at first stroke. What sets a great violin, like her Galliano, apart, says Keys, is more than a beautiful sound.
If you play concertos with orchestras, as I do occasionally, you've got to have an instrument that will basically penetrate the sound of 100 instruments behind you. So in order to get an instrument like that, you've got to come up with big bucks, which, of course, as a young musician, is very difficult.
For centuries, violin makers have tried to recreate the violins of the old masters.
There's something about making violins that's a lot more intricate, I think, than making guitars. It's just, there's so much more craft that goes into it, and that really appealed to me.
That's Alan DePisa, a second-year student here at North Bennett Street School in Boston's North End. He's huddled at his workbench in the violin-making studio, shaping one of four wooden blocks.
I did pharmaceutical research for about 10 years, and really just, I knew it wasn't for me. I wanted to do something that was satisfying, I don't know, I guess in a deeper way.
A 3/4-inch thick plywood violin-shaped mold, based on a Stradivarius, sits on his workbench. The blocks, soon to be attached to the mold, will become the corners of the instrument.
So a violin is constructed out of a few basic elements. You have your rib structure, your top and back plate, and then you have your neck or scroll.
The mold serves as a scaffold to put the components of the violin together. Nearby, third-year student Rose Clancy sits at her workbench, slowly carving out the arch of the front plate of her future string beauty.
If you follow the time-tested tradition and you're emulating Stradivari or Amati or Guarneri, and you've got all the right, you know, pieces together, it's probably going to sound pretty good if you're a good craftsperson.
However, building a great violin with a great sound is much more of an art than a science and comes from experience. Again, Alan DePisa.
Just from building a lot of violins. Here at school, we build the same violin model over and over again so that we can begin to predict and then alter our sound during the building process.
It's all about getting just the right thickness of the front and back plate of the instrument. The sound, at the final stage, can be tweaked by slight adjustments to the bridge and soundpost. Again, Rose Clancy.
If you know how to play, you have a sense of what you're looking for. For me, because I do play, I like the instrument to have a really direct sound. And I want it to be somewhat strong and somewhat sweet. I'm looking for an awful lot of things, you know, so I think that's the challenge of every maker.
Nobody, however, has been able to quite match the exact look and feel of a Stradivarius. Some say the secret is in the varnish. Jean-Philippe Béchard, a chemist at the Musée de la Musique in Paris, decided to track down the varnish recipe to preserve and maintain the instruments in the museum's violin collection.
They are important pieces of our heritage. They are witnesses of Stradivari's intention. With this instrument, using science, we are able to understand better the scope of the maker, their techniques.
Echar's team took samples of wood from 5 violins and put them through a battery of chemical tests to determine the varnish composition.
We know that Stradivari wanted them red.
The researchers found distinct red pigments in the varnish used by painters in that time period. Other than that, the components were typical of traditional violin finishes.
There might be no secret in the varnish. It might only be that Stradivari was a very skilled craftsman and mastered the way to mix the ingredients to achieve the effects he wanted.
What the exact recipe is, however, is still to be determined. So, violin makers like Alan DePisa will continue trying, one instrument at a time, to make a violin as beautiful as a Stradivarius, or just to create new sounds of their very own.
That concludes tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Lisa Zelig, who graduated from Boston University today with a bachelor's degree in television. She begins work next month as an assistant editor with a production company in Boston. Carolyn Burke, who received her degree in broadcast journalism today and works in the promotions department of Boston radio station WZLX. Varsha Yeshwant, who graduated today with a master's degree in photojournalism. She's looking for work as a multimedia journalist. Taylor Aldridge, who graduated today with a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism and is looking to begin his career as an online journalist. Michelle Flum, a graduate student at the Knight Center for Science Journalism at Boston University. She's currently working as an intern in the press office at Children's Hospital. Lindsay Dorman, also a graduate student at the Knight Center for Science Journalism. Before moving into journalism, she studied seafloor volcanoes and worked as a national park ranger. And Casey Atkins, who received a master's degree in photojournalism today and is looking to put her skills to use as a multimedia journalist. Thanks to Boston University Associate Professor Ann Donahue, who helped edit their stories. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Jared Mooney and Michael Garth. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Congratulations to all the graduates out there, and thanks for joining us this evening.